I'm Mushahid Hussain from London, and I'm delighted to present the second episode of Global South Voices on behalf of CGTN. This program is dedicated to providing a perspective to our viewers through the lens of the Global South, representing the world's majority. In today's episode, we will discuss the democratic systems of China and the United States in the context of a world which is witnessing turbulence and transformation. And we are very honored to have three distinguished guests from three different continents. We have Fred Membe, President of the Socialist Party of Zambia in Lusaka. We have Keith Bennett, Vice Chairman of the 48 Group. And we have Einar Tengen, based in Beijing, who is the founding partner of the China and Global Network, Chairman of Asia Narratives, and also from the Tehai Institute. We will start with our agenda focusing on people-centered versus capital-centered democracy, and I'd like to go first to Beijing to start with Mr. Tengen. Mr. Tengen, you are also seeing in Beijing the third International Forum on Democracy being organized, and the issues of democracy have become very relevant because in the West, democracy is often used as a weapon, human rights and democracy, to beat up countries that they feel are at variance with their perspectives. And although we saw the study of Harvard University a few years ago by the Ash Center, which said that in public opinion survey of China, over 90% of the people of China had expressed satisfaction with the Chinese political system. So given this context, how do you see the perspectives being presented by the West about China and China's own democratic development?
Well, I mean, the issue of democracy is that it's a system. It's one system which is supposed to be able to deliver government. Supposedly, democracies are better at a transition of governments because the people can vote out the government and they can vote in new leaders. But what you've seen, especially in the United States over the last 45 years, is that the middle class, which is really the bulwark of the kind of democracy that's in America, has literally come in tatters. 45 years ago, it was 62% of the population were middle class. Today, it's 50% and going lower. So you have a situation where, you know, the idea was that, yes, democracy can deliver, but today it is not. If you look at politics, and this is not only in the United States, but democratic systems that are championed by the U.S., what are they delivering leaders? Are they talking about issues that need to be talked about, like, you know, the $34 trillion in debt the U.S. government is piling up and is about to pile up more? Are they dealing with internal issues? Is it safe to walk the streets of the city? So democracy, in essence, is not failing the people, but the people are failing democracy. Now, you contrast that with China. They just recently had the two sessions. The two sessions were all about many, many ideas. What they did is they were concentrating on jobs for kids, the economic prospects. They were, you know, literally hundreds of suggestions made. Each one of those suggestions will be treated seriously and will be reported back on in terms of whether it can be done, what laws need to be adjusted, what policies need to be adjusted. But all of the system in China drives towards consensus. It tries to get everybody working in the same direction. And how do they do that? They do it based on values and this idea that no one is correct. It is just a question of how you solve the issues. Very, very different from the U.S., where you have entrenched parties who are battling back and forth over issues that they make into these huge bugbears, whether it's abortion or immigration, foreign policy, Afghanistan, Iraq, all the failed issues out there, currently Gaza, of course, and Ukraine.
I think very well put that whether the system delivers and you have leadership that can solve the problems, and also whether the leadership represents the voice of the people. I was seeing this public opinion polls regarding the war in Gaza and also in Ukraine, where a majority of Americans want a ceasefire on Gaza, but the American government policy is quite different. Your take on it, Mr. Membe, from Africa, how do you see that?
A country that tries to dominate others cannot claim to be democratic. A country that thrives on the exploitation, the humiliation of others, cannot claim to be democratic. And a country that is dominated by others, that is humiliated by others, can also not be democratic. What is happening in Gaza is very clear. The majority of the world's population are against what is going on in Gaza today. But one country, with a few countries that surround it, that are with it, are defying world public opinion on Gaza. They are allowing thousands of people to be butchered every day, to be killed in cold blood every day. This is not democracy. As Lincoln said also, and correctly so, democracy is government of the people, by the people, for the people. It must be a government that arises from the people. And when if we look at it that way, from the definition of Lincoln, you will see that what we see as democracy in the USA is nowhere near to that definition. And China is much more closer to that definition. There's more participation in China than in the USA in the governance of their country. So what we see in Gaza today is a reflection, is an extension of what is happening in the USA itself. Israel would not be able to do what it's doing in Gaza without the support of the United States. But where in the world has the United States really ever promoted democratic governance? Where in the world? Show me one country in the world where the USA has promoted democracy. Not even within the borders of the USA itself can we say there's democracy. What we see in the USA is not democracy, it's a sham.
That from 1947 to 1989, there were 64 attempts at regime change by the United States, mostly in different third world or developing countries of the global south. And many of the governments that were overthrown were democratic governments, whether it was in Iran in 53 or Chile in 1973. So you're absolutely right that it's not about, for the US, it's their own security interest, not about democracy at all.
Absolutely not. And I'd like to follow on really from what my friend from Zambia. We see a huge democratic deficit, I think, both in the individual countries in the West and also within international relations. How can it be democratic when the overwhelming majority of the countries in the world are demanding a ceasefire in Gaza, but one country can repeatedly veto that? That's not democracy. That's a tyranny of one. And we see it reflected here in Britain as well. We have a situation where both major parties are supporting the genocidal war being waged in Gaza by Israel. And yet over 70% of people in this country, in Britain, opinion polls repeatedly show this large majority of the population is demanding a ceasefire in government, both in Gaza. The government and the two major parties are quite out of sync with public opinion. So clearly for some people in Britain, if you vote the wrong way, democracy itself is alarming.
That is the key message, because when it comes to their core interests, and if the people take a decision, a popular opinion is against the interests of the, whether it's the British establishment or the American establishment, then it's not seen as a democratic choice. Also, I think that it also reflects the foreign policy priorities of these countries, Mr. Tengen, because we see that contrasting narratives are being presented. China talks of a community of shared future. America talks of America first. And the mindset is more black or white, zero-sum game. And it's not, as you said, based on consensus. And this foreign policy choices are now being exercised in a world which is multipolar, requiring a multilateral response, while the Washington playbook is still stuck with the Cold War of the Soviet Union.
Yes, I think it was best expressed by Blinken when he said, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. this is something that harkens back to the colonial period, where basically countries would just say they discovered other countries, although there are people there, and start carving them up as if they're there's some sort of turkey for dinner. The fact is, you hear all of these countries, U.S., Great Britain, everybody, they talk about illiberal democracies. And it's something bandied about when it's always talked about, especially with Putin and other places. But the fact is, this is exactly what they're doing. And the hypocrisy is what is killing all of these countries who say that they believe in international law, they adhere to international institutions, they believe that there are human rights. Well, right now, the emperor has no clothes. Consistently, you see governments run by elites who are, basically, Tweedledee and Tweedledum in most cases, especially on this Gaza issue. And, they're ignoring it. They say, well, this isn't a plebiscite. We know better. There are big things involved. It's complicated. Well, it's always simple when they want something, and it's always complicated when they're supposed to do something. It's kind of like the $100 billion a year that was supposed to be given to developing nations to help address climate concerns. That was supposed to start in 2020. What's happening in the world today is you have elites who are failing the people. They do not, they represent special interests. In order to solve this, you need to have systems which are actually responsive. And I don't mean that you take a plebiscite on every single issue, but there should be some basic norms. I mean, China has proposed three things: that there should be a security, global security initiative that makes sure that countries are secure and that their security doesn't depend on the insecurity of others. They've proposed that there be a development initiative, that countries have to have a way of developing. And they've said that they need a civilization initiative, one that brings respect and understanding of the different cultures in the world instead of treating them as if they're, pieces of some sort of animal that needs to be carved up and consumed by the developed and dominant nations. It's not just within these countries. Globally, we're undergoing changes. There's, with the digital world, so much is changing, robotics and things like this. We're undergoing a major change, but somehow there's a resistance, especially in the currently dominant and politically, economically, and certainly militarily dominant countries. And the irony is that they're failing themselves.
So to wean away Africa from China and from their natural allies, how do you see the Western role in this context at a time when the world requires a response that is based on cooperation and consensus rather than a new Cold War mindset that seems to be predominant in Western policies towards Africa?
For us, for a very long time, we lived in a world where only their security matters, only where their development matters, only where their better lives matter. Yes, they have the right to seek their own security, but they must let others also feel secure. Yes, they have the right to develop, but they must also let others develop while seeking their own development. Yes, they have the right to live better, to aspire to live better, but while aspiring to live better themselves, they must also let others feel secure. We believe that the highest level of political thought was reached when some human beings realized that, or became aware of the fact that the experience, the knowledge, the fruits of that intelligence of each human being should reach all others, and that no human being had the right to be a wolf, but to be brothers and sisters to all others. This, in our view, is the essence of the work that is going on in China today, seeking a world where all feel secure by cooperation, seeking a world where all develop by cooperation, seeking a world where all can aspire to live better through cooperation, win-win relationships.
As you said, that let us have our own way. It's not the American approach, our way or the highway. And Mr. Bennett, it seems that even issues like climate change are being weaponized. I was recently reading that on the issue of electric vehicles in the United States, they had given a tax rebate of $7,500 that if you buy an EV, electric vehicle. But since most of the electric vehicles have Chinese batteries, they have taken that away. So the environment of the US will suffer, climate change issues will suffer because of their animus towards China. So that seems to be an approach like cutting your nose to spite your face, even on an issue like a global threat like climate change. Mr. Bennett.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. We see the things that you've referred to in the United States. The European Union is making similar moves. Recently, just this week, the newspaper, the Daily Telegraph in Britain, reported that there were proposals under consideration for the United Kingdom to bring in sanctions against Chinese electric vehicles on the grounds that they were supposedly flooding the market in Britain. And I think this is really quite extraordinary. It's a kind of end of empire death wish, if you like, the kind of thing that you see, the kind of self-destructive things that you see of empires going back in history to the Roman Empire as they reach their end. If the climate issue should tell us one thing, it should tell us that there are huge problems and, of course, also huge opportunities, but huge existential problems facing humanity that affect every single country in the world without exception. We saw this to some extent with COVID, but issues of zoonotic pandemics, climate catastrophe, nuclear war, and so on, these are issues that can't be solved by any one country alone. They can only be solved by countries working together. But the United States and Britain, by and large, are not taking this attitude. They still have this winner takes all, beggar my neighbour approach. We saw it with their use of vaccine diplomacy, and we're seeing it with their completely irresponsible attitude to the huge threat of climate catastrophe. And climate catastrophe is not going to spare the United States. We've seen extreme weather conditions across the United States. We see that California, the Sunshine State, is already facing severe environmental and meteorological problems as a result of climate change. And I think this really goes to the crux of two different ways of looking at the world. There's the way, the my way or the highway, winner takes all of the United States, which is not only failing the countries that the developed world pledged to help at repeated COP meetings, it's failing their own country and their own people. And I think we have to contrast this to what President Xi Jinping is putting forward about a shared future for humanity. And this, I think, in the West, to the extent it's commented on, some people might just try to dismiss it as a slogan or a soundbite. But it's not. It's a real practical program. It's not only a practical problem. I would say it's a practical necessity that a community of a shared future for humanity, which President Xi is proposing, is not something that's simply desirable. It's actually essential if we as a species are going to continue meet the challenges that all of humanity is facing now.
Yes, Mr. Tengen. And I was also seeing this report of the U.S. intelligence community. It's called the Annual Threat Assessment, and they devoted a largest number of pages to China, the so-called Chinese threat containment of China. So it seems the U.S. strategic culture is still based on that old view of the 19th century, the Monroe Doctrine, spheres of influence, hegemony, ensuring your own diktat, and in search of enemies. How do you view that, Mr. Tengen?
Well, absolutely true. I mean, we saw that in the 70s, what they did to Japan. Remember that in 1986, Japan signed the Plaza Accord. In today's dollar terms, Japan's economy is worth less today than it was in 1986, when it was in essence forced to sign that. Everything that the U.S. is saying about China today was said about Japan. You had members of Congress and Senate bashing Toshiba radios and Toyota and Honda cars. And it's just this sense in America that no one can be trusted and only America should be in control. This was a kind of post-World War II mentality where they said, we can't trust the Europeans, they always get us into trouble. We can't trust the rest of the world because we're basically racist. And so what we're going to do is we're going to be in charge of everything, and we're going to take whatever we need in order to finance that. And basically, they became an economic colonial power. The U.S., you know, really has this sense that it is anointed. And this was positioning the U.S. for being morally right, also biblically right. And therefore, there's no arguing, you know. Truthfully, the Chinese prefer somebody like Kissinger because, you know, he deals in real power facts. You can make a deal with somebody like that. You might not like it. You might not like what they're doing. But you can arrive at some sort of conclusion. When you're arguing with somebody who believes that they're right and you're wrong, there's nothing you can do. And China is now stuck in what they call the philosophical prisoner's dilemma. You have an overwhelmingly powerful, militarily powerful nation, which is routinely threatening you, forming alliances against you, making it clear they're looking for an opportunity to have one of their minions attack you and try to weaken you and prevent you from rising economically. This is the old playbook that we've always used, but it isn't working. I mean, the difference between the 70s and today is that China, over the last 8 years, has been rising at average rate of 6.5%. The U.S. has been rising at 2%. And this is really the crux that worries America, is that it is losing, that it's losing its edge. They're fearful that China represents the kind of example that will push other nations to not only speak out, but to take action. This is really what frightens both Europe and America, that you'll have consortiums of countries coming together and not, you know, begging anymore, but saying this is the way the price is going to be. And this is really at the crux of China's rise. It's not just China itself as a competitor. It's what China represents. It's what, you know, the Middle East represented with OPEC. And this is really truly frightening, because it would oversee the transfer back of the wealth that was stolen. And, you know, we only have to look at what is now called India to understand that when the British arrived, that area was 24% of the world's GDP. When they left, it was 4%. So clearly, there needs to be changes. But clearly, those countries that benefited from their colonial past don't want to recognize that.
I think that's the key thing, that it's the fear of China is not just based on China's peaceful rise, but it's also what, as you said rightly, Mr. Tengen, that what China represents today. And I was recently reading this report of the Harvard University by Professor Graham Allison. It's called The Great Tech Rivalry, China versus the United States, where he says China is overtaking the United States in high-tech manufacturing, whether it's and the issues of artificial intelligence, 5G, robotics, cloud computing, STEM. So I think that a non-Western power rising peacefully is something which is not acceptable. And Mr. Member, that this Chinese path to development, which irks the United States, so it's not about public opinion or the interests of the people, it's about U.S. interests, and they determine what are the interests of the recipient country. Mr. Member?
It's impossible to continue to live in a world where the interests of the United States reign supreme. What we have today is a choice between China and the United States. What we have today is a choice between a community being built with a shared future, a world that is being constructed with a shared future, or America first. Is that a choice? There's no choice there. What we have before us today is a choice between common security or American security. It's not simply a question of following China blindly. No, we fully agree with the path that the Chinese people are pursuing.
I think that's the important thing, the shift in the tectonic plates of geopolitics and geoeconomics in the world, where the global center of gravity is shifting from the West to the East. And we are seeing this historical change where the center of gravity once in the West, now the rise of the global South. With that, we come to the end of this episode. Many thanks to our guests. You can also find us on CGTN app, YouTube, X, and Facebook. I'm Mushahid Hussain. Thanks for being with us. Please stay tuned to Global South Voices, CGTN's debut program for Global South countries, and look at today's world from a different perspective. See you next time.
Dive into news like never before with Deep Dive, the podcast from CGTN Radio. Join our global reporters for captivating stories and thought-provoking conversations. Search Deep Dive on your favorite podcast platforms and get ready to dive in.
Discover the realities and responses to our changing climate with Climate Watch. Uncover critical issues such as the Masai Mara's disrupted wildebeest migration and the drop in the Panama Canal's water levels. Delve into solutions for a sustainable future. Tune in to Climate Watch on your favorite podcast platform. Become more eco-conscious and take action to protect our planet.